Hello, I'm Richard Marks, ASI's Research Director, and welcome to ASI Cast number 138. Today I'm chatting with Bill Harvey. Bill is founder and chairman of Research Measurement Technologies. Now, Bill pioneered the development of set-top box data for audience measurement in his days at Next Century Media and then TRA, and has had an extensive career in the varied approaches to video measurement. At some points in our career, we've no doubt been rivals pitching to the same clients. Now, as listeners will know, we're at a very fluid point in video currency measurement at the moment, particularly with the highly unstable situation in the US that we've been covering in some of our recent podcasts. We thought it might be interesting to have a chat with Bill about the current state of measurement and the relative merits of the various tools that are out there. Now, it's been commented before that in the past, measurement may have been more like being a farmer, gathering data from lovingly tended crops or panels. Arguably today, it's now more like being a chef, combining a range of measurement ingredients from different sources. So let's examine the current state of some of those ingredients. Now, just a word of warning, we're not planning to talk about specific companies, their offerings, or the current politics, but the pros and cons of the different approaches based on our hands-on experience. So this should be of interest to all practitioners, regardless of which market you're working in. So firstly, welcome to the podcast, Bill.
Well, thank you for having me here. 138, wow. What an impressive record.
I know. I think it's 6 years we've been going. So we didn't quite realize we'd get this far, but... Let's kick off with a topic that I know is close to your heart, Bill, which is return path data from set-top boxes and streaming services. How do you think they fit into the measurement picture now compared to when they first came on the scene over a decade ago?
Well, you know, my approach has always been to use them as a supplementary measure. We were never out to displace the incumbent or anything like that. But we felt... In fact, I tried many times years ago to bring local TV measurement up a step or two with set-top box data, suggesting not only to the cable companies and the other MVPDs, but also to Nielsen, that it would be a great way to improve local TV market measurement. And then at TRA, I used it mostly for reaching particular audiences, such as heavy swing purchasers of specific CPG brands in order to maximize ROI. So it was always, in my mind, something that would add to rather than displace metered panels and such. But today, much more ambitious contemplations are based around the set-top box. And like everyone's using it now, which is kind of a great thing. You know, I think I mentioned that I'm getting an Emmy for the pioneering development of set-top box data. So It's kind of fun for me to see this. Obviously, the fact that it now does replace diaries in local TV measurement in the US is an enormous improvement. Areas were just so inadequate for, you know, what's going on now. So some of the lasting benefits of set-top boxes, where even today they add to other things, is the second-by-second nature of the measurement. You know, it's becoming more important now with discoveries by Paul Donato and others that maybe even two-second commercials would be a good idea. But certainly people are using 5 and 6 second commercials a lot lately. So being able to break the minute and get down to seconds is something that is important, and set-top boxes are good there. Another prominent benefit of set-top boxes that people have realized is that they add stability. Report to report stability is very important to be able to predict audiences, particularly if you're making guarantees between buyer and seller as to what's going to be delivered. You want stability, and set-top box data is good for injecting that, even with other measures. And then there's addressable TV. With addressable TV, the future has to be census level measurement. Otherwise, you're going to be missing some of the deliveries and you'll have to use modeling to try to replace them. And modeling isn't a perfect replacement for measurement, as you and I know. There are still a couple of areas where set-top box data could be made better. One of them is, you know, the old problem of you don't know when the set-top box is on and the TV set is off. Well, TiVo cracked that code years ago and invented a heartbeat mechanism where using capacitance and other measures of feedback from the TV set, you're able to actually know when the TV set is on or off. Everyone should be using that, but they're not yet. And then there's this new problem that set-top boxes didn't have before, where when it's connected to a smart TV and the smart TV goes off the reservation and goes into the internet and starts looking around, the set-top box, most of them, not all of them, but most of the providers of set-top box data, it still reports being on the last of the traditional channels that it was into through its own tuner. So still room for improvement, but I think set-top boxes are making a very positive contribution and makes me happy.
Yeah, when you get your Emmy, you have to be very careful not to insult anyone's wife because we don't want another situation. So congratulations on that, by the way. Arguably, there is a bit of an irony around the fact that set-top box data is now being used more and more. The first is a very obvious one, which is that certainly for the last 10 to 15 years, it's not positioned on top of the set-top. We've never come up with an alternative for it, but very few people have cathode ray tubes that can stand a set-top box on top. But I guess the other irony, and you've touched on it there, is that with the massive growth in streaming, it means that the assumption that most of the content going through a TV screen is coming from a set-top box is increasingly diminishing. And I know that latest stats show that most of the growth in connected streaming viewing is coming from apps within sets as opposed to connected digital boxes. And particularly, there's a lot of interest around the potential measurement applications of smart or connected TV data. Does that present different challenges in terms of how you integrate smart TV data than traditional set-top box data, for want of a better phrase?
Yeah, it does have its own peculiar characteristics in terms of challenges of measurement. For one thing, you know, it's fingerprint based rather than watermark based. And fingerprinting isn't as perfect as watermarking is in terms of always being able to make an identification. So lack of an ability to make an identification stems from really two things. One, the fact that you're having to match against a reference library. And the other is that for economic reasons, people are limiting the sizes of their reference library. So you have a problem in that perhaps many as, in some cases, 23% was the highest number I've seen of non-matches, where things go into all other TV rather than get credited to a particular or channel, which is, you know, not a good thing. And you can try to distribute the no answers, so to speak. You know, you could try to model it out, but that isn't very accurate. And people in the smart TV side of things have decided to limit the number of networks they're measuring, and certainly to limit the number of TV stations they're measuring as program sources. Mostly they're sticking to major TV stations and major markets. So a great number of the program sources don't even have a chance to be credited. And then there is this other error that occurs all too frequently to not enable a match. So, you know, one of those things is easily fixed. All you have to do is throw money at it, and a much larger reference library. So that solution is visible. Fingerprinting being replaced by watermarking seems to me to be something that will inevitably happen. It seemed impossible in the early days of PPM, but right now, many program sources and content creators are putting in the watermark codes for PPM, not only in the US, but in other countries. So it kind of proved that you can do it. It would take years to convince everybody to do it, but I think it'll go that way eventually. And you know, in terms of this corner cutting to keep the costs down, it also extends to time shifting, where most of the smart TV measurement is stopping at 7 days and not including, you know, any viewing after that on a time shifting basis. Some of the problem, and then, you know, even in terms of measuring streaming, the smart TV ACR solutions have contractual limitations on what the streaming services want reported. So there's not a complete set of streaming data coming through smart TVs as people have suspected. But Richard, I left out half the story, because the other half of the story is certainly if you want a complete measurement of television today, you've got to have smart TV data. Eventually, it's all going to be smart TV data. Mm. Can't ignore it and say, I'm not going to use it because it's not perfect. But the big problem comes from the number of smart TVs that you can get data from in a given household. Typically, if you're buying smart TV data, you're buying it from one manufacturer, one TV set manufacturer, and which exacerbates the problem, because there may be a household that's got all smart TVs, five of them, and they're from diverse manufacturers. But the basic rule of thumb nowadays is if you have smart TV data, you're covering 1.1 TV sets per average household. Set-top box is covering an average of 2.8. And when you find them in the same household, and I've looked at data like this, there are hundreds of thousands of households that I've looked at that have both smart TV and set-top box data. And you ask the question, well, how much is reported only by the smart TV and how much is reported only by the set-top box and how much is reported in common? What you find is something like 4% is reported only by the smart TV. 43% is reported only by the set-top boxes and the rest is in common. Mm-hmm. So it would be very dangerous to base an entire measurement system just on smart TVs. If you were going to do that, you would definitely want to get all the manufacturers, but it would still be problematical.
I mean, I agree. What we're talking about primarily when we talk about reference sites and signatures is what's referred to as, I think, ACR, Advanced Content Recognition Systems, which are typically built into smart TVs. But that's largely there because those TVs still have a tuner and are either taking, you know, over the air in some countries, less prevalent in the US, but very prevalent in the UK, for example, or they are still connected to a, you know, a Comcast set-top box or whatever. But if you look in the UK, Sky Glass, which has recently launched, or Amazon's launch of their Fire TV Omni, they're effectively streaming TVs. So I guess the question there is whether it's less about ACR, because Sky are claiming with Sky Glass that they will know everything going through the television, because everything going through the television will be effectively IP-based, and therefore they will be going to the source of that as opposed to needing to recognize it. So it's interesting, it's almost coming full circle to where perhaps the actual smart TV becomes the set-top box data, if you see what I mean, as opposed to having to use ACR. I don't know how, we're probably a decade away from that, but there's gonna be almost like a third type of data source, which is pure play streaming TVs. I know you can buy TV sets without tuners in some markets now, which solves a lot of problems.
Well, you know, the streaming data is at the server. So there are scenarios in which all of the networks, streaming networks, get together and pool their data, maybe have the MRC accredit it, and make sure it's no fraudulent hypoing, et cetera. The future is still not determined.
Mm. The future isn't written. I don't know whose quote that was, but it actually sounds like something from Star Trek. But so we're hearing the global research companies claiming, and this was a big theme at our ASI conference back in November, that panels are more important than ever now, given the imminent demise of the cookie and also increasing privacy limitations on what you can track and the degree to which you can use unconsented data, for want of a better phrase. Do you think we're seeing the second coming of the TV panel? And if so, what's their role in this future?
I do. I actually do. And of course, the World Federation of Advertisers and the ANA and ISBA and the other similar organizations in 34 countries have penned this requirement for the future that cross-platform measurement will be based both on big data and on panels. That's where all the money comes from, the top of the mountain where the money avalanche begins. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a form of proof that, yes, panels have definitely, we've seen the value of panels. Part of it, though, is also the complex ways in which the television can, which television slash video can be used by the end users. You know, the number of different devices, different styles of viewing live and streaming and so on and so forth, so that you have this complex pattern of intercombinations of stuff going on in one household, but not in another household. So the number of little balkanized islands of complexity of different media availability patterns. How do you know you're covering all of those representatively if you're selectively using just one mode, whether it be smart TV or set-top box, or even if you're buying set-top box and smart TV data and putting it together in the very best way possible? How are you ever going to be sure that you've got the right mixes? Mm. Homes that have, for example, set-top box data and smart TV data and connected TV data and device level, other non-TV device viewing levels. How do you know you've got the right mix of those in your sample of homes that can use TV that particular number of different ways? Unless you have some kind of a calibration sample, something ideally in the US, you know, our thinking is always probability samples, area probability samples, less intoxicating to the rest of the world than to us in the US. But since I was trained in the US, I have this affection for the idea of probability samples. But mm. you need some kind of a measure to enable you to put together the other stuff with a sense of true confidence. I mean, maybe you don't want to go that way. Maybe you want to go, you don't need that degree of confidence. All you need to know is, this is the pattern today. It's going to be pretty stable tomorrow. We can make a deal based on this CPM against this target. And we can, if as long as we stick with the same measurement system for the post as in the pre, it may not even matter whether it's real or not or true or not. But we've made a deal and we can carry out the deal.
Mm.
People think that way now. It's an unusual way to think for, you know, anybody who's been a research person.
Yeah, there does seem to be a consensus around the importance of panels from everyone, nearly everyone at the moment. But where the point of differentiation seems to come is more around the emphasis, in that if you talk to one group, the panel is seen as the core of what's being done, effectively the foundations of the building and the lift shaft that runs up the middle, and that the other sources of data, you know, the floors are hung around that central core lift shaft. Conversely, some people argue that the panel is really off to one side, a bit like the architect's plan that tells you how to put the building together, but it's needed. But it's I guess your view on that depends on whether you're the person with the panel or whether you're the person seeking to buy in some panel data. But I think the jury is still out on the degree to which the panel is the core of what you're doing, or whether it's providing you what's been referred to as a source of truth to check that what you've done is okay.
Well, it's really fascinating because even after my years in the business and probably having some fixed ideas based on my experiences, like all of us have, I guess, to some degree, I had an aha conversion moment just a little while ago when I was fortunate enough to see the what Nielsen calls its impact data. So they published data, at least to their clients, and some of their clients are my clients, so I'm able to look at some data. And so the September 2021 panel only versus panel with 30 million households worth of set-top box and smart TV data, 87.8% of the program ratings between the two of them are within 0.02 rating points. So the aha moment that hit me was they must be measuring the same thing. Mm. And if that thing that they're both measuring isn't reality, what is it? How can two very different methods agree like that? So I then, you know, dug in further and called my friends at Nielsen, and I said, is this like meter diary integration? And no, it isn't meter diary integration. It's true consistency. Mm-hmm. They are making use of the panel where there are common homes and common devices to see, you know, where the device at the device, same device level measured by two different meters, gets different answers, or gets answers in one case and blanks in another case and stuff like that. So, I mean, panels are useful for helping to clean the big data. The big data are going to be essential for the future, for addressable, for cross-platform. You can't just do it with the panel anymore. You have to do it with both. And how you put those both together is a whole new vista of measurement science for us old timers to be reborn into.
Another increasing development is the increased interest in panels that offer things like eyes on technology, tracking actual viewing, as it's put, as opposed to what we've been measuring largely up to this point, which is, you know, typically presence in the room, or at least that someone is, you know, is theoretically able to watch, as opposed to tracking their eyes or their corneas or their heat signatures or whatever. I know from my own experience back running a measurement company, we used to get people in two or three times a year with alternatives to the traditional handset that's used by most meters. But it does seem to be getting traction, particularly around the interest in attention. Do you see attention as a potential input to planning and trading, or is it more, as I think Paul Donato described it in our last episode, a supplementary currency that sits on top of the core currency?
Well, if the definition of currency is the ability to make a guaranteed deal between buyer and seller, there's nothing to stop buyers and sellers from making deals like that. I would guess that Dentsu, for example, would probably be contemplating making such deals, or actually making them right now, where, you know, you go back about 10 years, Tracy Shapak might have been, when she was at Starcom, might have been the first person to ever do a deal that was currency guaranteed based on set-top box data with Discovery. That might have been the first non-panel based guarantee that the world saw in the US. And so deals like that can be made. They can be made guaranteeing any number of different levels of the ARF model. You know, the ARF model, something that I loved from the first moment I noticed it in my first year in the business. That if you go back in time to the original model, they wanted to have something like attention in it. They had six levels. Alfred Politz argued very persuasively for why there should be a perception level after the exposure level. The exposure has always been an opportunity to see, meaning it was delivered to the glass. And then anyone who was within range with their eyes open and maybe looking in the right direction, but you know, ears can pick up in multiple directions, would have an opportunity to see or hear or both that ad. So it's always been an opportunity to see rather than an actual seeing. So Politz wanted to get seeing in there, but they back then, you know, 1958, et cetera, they didn't have eye camera tracking as a logical option to consider. So they didn't include it in the model. But then in 2002, when Erwin Efren and Jim Spaeth and Bill Moran and Denman Maroney and Phil Brandon and I updated the ARF model, which had been attempted by Paul Chook and never got past the ARF board, but we lucked out. And so we got a couple of more measures in there, including attention. And the problem with making a guarantee implies that the media owner has some control over something. If, you know, when once you get past the opportunity and the attention, some of that, maybe most of it, is coming from the creator.
Exactly, yeah.
And so if the media owner is making a guarantee based on attention, doesn't the media owner have to like get an ASI pretest verifying that it's a potent commercial that will get attention, at least at a normal level? Or don't you need to cover yourself?
I'd always assumed that the attention we were talking about, the advertisers being interested in, would be attention to the program, the content, the indication that this was an engaging environment for their ad. As you say, the doing guarantees on attention to the advert effectively de-risks the whole advertising industry, because if they put out a crap ad, they won't have to pay for it, because the eye tracking would tell you no one watched it, so that you don't have to charge for it. So I would have thought the media owners could see a role for particularly those media owners who feel they have quality environments, like broadcasters who will feel they have that advantage over, you know, social media and video sharing platforms, would be keen on attention to content as being a metric, but attention to actual advertisers' content, as you say, I think it is really down to them. I mean, they'll want to measure it, but that's been measured, you know, how successful ad creative is obviously pre-tested and for decades. So that's less of an issue, but it's a fascinating topic, and when we often return to ASI, because I know the Attention Council and a former colleague of mine, Eddie Brown, is involved in very much in raising awareness around attention. But I'm conscious of time, but I wanted to ask you, what else is there out there that you're aware of that a good measurement chef might be needing to consider as possible ingredients? What else is on the horizon, do you think?
Well, this is very similar to attention. So let me start by adding a little more about attention and then transitioning. So the value, I always called it media impact. I always imagined, and I wasn't the only one, that the purpose, this was never said actually anywhere in writing, but I always imagined that the purpose of the ARF model was that it was a blueprint, a plan, looking into the future where we were going to go up level by level. We were going to, right now we're measuring, right now, you know, being in the 1960s, we're measuring the opportunities to see as well as we possibly can, we thought at the time. There were only, you know, three networks in the US, so it was really easy with 1,000 panel to get really good data. At any rate, then we hoped it would move up to being able to measure the communications effects. And we would actually have like a Nielsen report to open, and we'd have all of the different media choices, and it would give us some measures of communications effects, you know, either recall or the level above it, persuasion. You know, we'll be able to measure the persuasion averages by, you know, people who watch This Is Us versus XYZ. And then we'd get to sales effects. Now, of course, at TRA, I actually tried to do that.
I remember.
And at one point, Leslie Wood was helping us with it. And we did call it Media Impact back in 2012 when we were doing that work together. So it's always been a dream of mine, a fond dream, that we would get beyond the opportunities to see, not so much as to, you know, be able to base media guarantees, because once you go past there, a lot of it is the creative. Most of it is the creative. Most of the advertising business is about the creative, but we lose sight of that. So then the Attention Council and all of the members, and Andy and Mark Goldman and others, Max Kalehoff, are making wonderful contributions to theory and to thinking more deeply about it. But the whole thing does depend on the ability to prove that these measurements help us get more attention and get more outcomes out of it. So at the ARF yesterday, for example, Meta, in a panel with Paul Donato, showed these curves that, like in Facebook, 18,000 different ads being measured. The ones that converted, you could see them in the first 2 seconds. You could identify them in the first 2 seconds. You didn't need more, because after the first 2 seconds, the conversions didn't go up anymore. Now, that was different in different platforms, different devices, et cetera. In some cases, it did take 8 seconds or whatever to get a best prediction of conversions. I mean, there are a lot of questions here. Like a lot of the work we're doing on attention is based on the eye. What about the ear? You know, what about people who aren't looking at the screen but are getting the commercial? Paul Donato yesterday at the ARF used the phrase, TV works at low attention. You know, it's a system one, Kahneman system one, as compared to any kind of computer device with the built-in ADHD that comes along with it. The quick twitch and the, you know, loss of attention and go on to the next oxytocin blast in the brain. At any rate, the real question is about these sales effects, ultimately, and the branding effects. So the Attention Council has done a wonderful job of compiling the proof that attention does lead to those things, which only a fool would have not expected. And so then the question is, what else can we use as a predictor of the outcome? Well, at TRA, I was always into the idea of, well, we can see patterns. We can see, for example, that a mature packaged goods brand optimizes ROI on frequency at about 3 opportunities to see a week per household, which converts into much fewer actual lookings and so on and so forth. But now we have possibility of using attention norms, AUs, for example, Adelaide's term, or anything comparable to that as predictive attention. And it's based on the context rather than on the, but again, as you say, if the context is high attention, like we know news has higher attention, it may have other problems nowadays with divisiveness and so on and so forth, but or perceived problems. I'm not sure that they're really advertising problems. So if you go into a high attention context, will it rub off on your ad? I think we have a lot of evidence that yes, it will. It will give your ad a better head start. So then a transition into what else can you do? Well, it turns out that alignment between the program and the ad has a similar effect to predictive attention. It's different. I think the two of them are probably additive. So this is my own work now, RMT. So RMT, as you probably know, has empirically derived 265 psychological variables that can be used in content coding of ads and programs. So you can now look at a resonance score. To what extent does the program reflect, mirror, align with, be contiguous with, not break the mood of the program, but actually flow with the mood of the program? We've seen, 36% increases in sales effect, 62% increases in first brand unaided mention, and scores like that coming from companies like Nielsen NCS, 605, Simmons, Neustar. So there's a lot of evidence that if you put your ad into resonant contexts, you can also affect the downstream outcomes. And if you do that and use the attention measures, then you're probably giving your ad much better probability of having a positive effect. So I think that there's already four major advertisers using us on an every month basis, which is many more brands than that. But it's a slow, we're introducing something new. And the funny thing about it is you get reactions like this, a gentleman named Fadi Karam, who I've had the privilege to work with three times now. As he moves from company to company, he always wants to use what I just described. And the first time I met him, he said, "Bill, for 16 years, I've sat in this seat. I won't mention the name of the major advertiser, one of the largest in the world." He said, "I've sat in this seat and people have come to me and told me they can optimize my media. But you're the first one who said they had to see my commercials before they could do that."
Well, yeah, I mean, a colleague of Mike and I, Brian Jacobs, I'm sure if he's watching, would be nodding away at your emphasis on the importance of creative in the whole advertising process. Absolutely. Finally, I'm going to ask you the same question that I put to Paul Donato, and this kind of tie up all the things we've been talking about, because at the moment there are a lot of ingredients out there and there are an increasing number of players, particularly in the US market, who are chefs who are getting their meals together in the hope that the industry will use them. And that's led to a lot of talk about alt currencies at the moment and a lot of companies that are combining those ingredients and hoping that they will be either the currency or used as a currency. What's your take on the current uncertainty in the US market? Could multiple currencies be the way forward, or is that, forgive the pun, a recipe for disaster?
Well, from a certain point of view, the concept of it is something likable in that there's always been this saying among insiders in audience measurement that in any given media, in any given country, the industry is willing to support 1.5 profitable measurement companies. You couldn't actually have two profitable companies in any given field. And that was because the industry didn't want to pay for more, although they wanted innovation. But then they wound up with, well, the JIC approach worked very well in all the countries that did it, I think, compared to in the US, where we always said, "Oh, Robinson, Patman, blah, 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 blah. That's not good. You can't do that." You wound up typically with one supplier, and that one supplier was a natural monopoly. And then people got mad at the one supplier. And that's a pattern. Wherever you have one supplier, you save money, but you get angry. So, trade-off. Anger is not good. It lowers your immune system and so on and so forth. So now, if it were really to come to pass that we would support five different good measurement services in the US, it would be fantastic from the point of view of competition, innovation. We'd speed up the gears of progress. I would love it. But Would it cause confusion? I think so. I mean, the first thing that would happen is you would see, gee, why does this network prefer this measurement service? Mm. Oh, gosh, there'll be a high correlation between the number of cases where they're getting a higher number from that measurement service. And that, yeah, it's a correlation of like a 0.8. I wonder if that has anything causative or if that's just accidental. You know, that'll be the first thing. So that would sow doubt and so on. But where will it actually pan out? I think there'll be a lot of experimentation. It'll be very healthy. It already is speeding up innovation from everybody, every side. People are doing things that they didn't do before, and they're doing them faster. And they're trying to exceed each other in quality and thinking about things and getting deeper into them. It's a wonderful time to be in the business.
Mm. Well, that's a great note to end on, really, because that's one of the reasons why we thought it would be a great time to talk to you with your vast experience of what's going on and also your ongoing work. So thanks for making time to speak to us. I'm sure we'll catch up again in the not too distant future, and plenty to chew on in that conversation. So thanks a lot, Bill.
Thank you. I look forward to talking to you again soon.